Pacific, where Ahab, though everywhere else foiled in his pursuit, firmly counted upon giving battle to Moby Dick. In the sea he was most known to frequent, and at a season when he might most reasonably be presumed to be haunting it. But does Ahab touch no land? Does his crew drink air? Surely he will stop for water. Nay, for while other hulls are loaded down with alien stuff to be transferred to foreign wharves, the world-wandering whale ship carries no cargo but herself and crew, their weapons, and their wants. She has a whole lake's contents bottled in her ample hold. She carries years' water in her, clear old prime Nantucket water, which, when 3 years afloat, the Nantucketer in the Pacific prefers to drink before the brackish fluid but yesterday rafted off in casks from the Peruvian or Indian streams. Hence it is that, while other ships may have gone to China from New York and back again, touching at a score of ports, the whale ship in all that interval may not have sighted one grain of soil, her crew having seen no man but floating seamen like themselves. And so the good old Pequod gained more and more upon Java Head. Now, as many sperm whales had been captured off the western coast of Java, in the near vicinity of the Straits of Sunda, indeed as most of the ground round about was generally recognized by the fishermen as an excellent spot for cruising, therefore, as the Pequod gained more and more upon Java Head, the lookouts were repeatedly hailed and admonished to keep wide awake. But though the green palmy cliffs of the land soon loomed on the starboard bow, and with delighted nostrils the fresh cinnamon was snuffed in the air, yet not a single jet was descried. Almost renouncing all thought of falling in with any game hereabouts, the ship had well nigh entered the straits, when the customary cheering cry was heard from aloft, and ere long a spectacle of singular magnificence saluted us. But here be it premised that owing to the unwearied activity with which of late they have been hunted over all four oceans, the sperm whales, instead of almost invariably sailing in small, detached companies as in former times, are now frequently met with in extensive herds, sometimes embracing so great a multitude that it would almost seem as if numerous nations of them had sworn solemn league and covenant for mutual assistance and protection. To this aggregation of the sperm whale into such immense caravans may be imputed the circumstance that even in the best cruising grounds you may now sometimes sail for weeks and months together without being greeted by a single spout, and then be suddenly saluted by what sometimes seems thousands on thousands. Broad on both bows, at the distance of some 2 or 3 miles, and forming a great semicircle, embracing one half of the level horizon, a continuous chain of whale jets were upplaying and sparkling in the noonday air. Unlike the straight perpendicular twin jets of the right whale, which, dividing at the top, fall over in two branches like the cleft drooping boughs of a willow, the single, forward-slanting spout of the sperm whale presents a thick, curled bush of white mist, continually rising and falling away to leeward. Seen from the Pequod's deck, then, as she would rise on a high hill of the sea, this host of vapory spouts, individually curling up into the air and beheld through a blending atmosphere of bluish haze, showed like the thousand cheerful chimneys of some dense metropolis, descried of a balmy autumnal morning by some horseman on a height. As marching armies approaching an unfriendly defile in the mountains accelerate their march, all eagerness to place that perilous passage in their rear and once more expand in comparative security upon the plain, even so did this vast fleet of whales now seem hurrying forward through the straits, gradually contracting the wings of their semicircle and swimming on in one solid but still crescentric center. Crowding all sail, the Pequod pressed after them, the harpooners handling their weapons and loudly cheering from the heads of their yet suspended boats. If the wind only held, little doubt had they that, chased through these straits of Sunda, the vast host would only deploy into the Oriental seas to witness the capture of not a few of their number. And who could tell whether, in that congregated caravan, Moby Dick himself might not temporarily be swimming, like the worshipped white elephant in the coronation procession of the Siamese. So with stunsail piled on stunsail, we sailed along, driving these leviathans before us, when of a sudden the voice of Tashtego was heard, loudly directing attention to something in our wake. Corresponding to the crescent in our van, we beheld another in our rear. It seemed formed of detached white vapors, rising and falling something like the spouts of the whales, only they did not so completely come and go, for they constantly hovered without finally disappearing. Leveling his glass at this sight, Ahab quickly revolved in his pivot hole, crying,
"Aloft there, and rig ropes and buckets to wet the sails! Malays, and after us!"
As if too long lurking behind the headlands, till the Pequod should fairly have entered the straits, these rascally Asiatics were now in hot pursuit to make up for their overcautious delay. But when the swift Pequod, with a fresh leading wind, was herself in hot chase, how very kind of these tawny philanthropists to assist in speeding her on to her own chosen pursuit. As with glass under arm, Ahab to and fro paced the deck, in his forward turn beholding the monsters he chased, and in the after one the bloodthirsty pirates chasing him. Some such fancy as the above seemed his. But thoughts like these troubled very few of the reckless crew, and when, after steadily dropping and dropping the pirates astern, the Pequod at last shot by the vivid green cockatoo point on the Sumatra side, emerging at last upon the broad waters beyond, then the harpooners seemed more to grieve that the swift whales had been gaining upon the ship than to rejoice that the ship had so victoriously gained upon the Malays. But still driving on in the wake of the whales, at length they seemed abating their speed. Gradually the ship neared them, and, the wind now dying away, word was passed to spring to the boats. But no sooner did the herd, by some presumed wonderful instinct of the sperm whale, become notified of the three keels that were after them, though yet a mile in their rear, than they rallied again, forming into close ranks and battalions, so that their spouts all looked like flashing lines of stacked bayonets. They moved on with redoubled velocity. Stripped to our shirts and drawers, we sprang to the white ash, and after several hours pulling were almost disposed to renounce the chase, when a general pausing commotion among the whales gave animating token that they were now at last under the influence of that strange perplexity of inert irresolution which, when the fishermen perceive it in the whale, they say he is gallied. The compact martial columns in which they had been hitherto rapidly and steadily swimming were now broken up in one measureless rout. They seemed going mad with consternation. In all directions, expanding in vast, irregular circles, and aimlessly swimming hither and thither, by their short, thick spoutings they plainly betrayed their distraction of panic. This was still more strangely evinced by those of their number who, completely paralyzed, as it were, helplessly floated like waterlogged, dismantled ships on the sea. Had these leviathans been but a flock of simple sheep, pursued over the pasture by three fierce wolves, they could not possibly have evinced such excessive dismay. But this occasional timidity is characteristic of almost all herding creatures. Though banding together in tens of thousands, the lion-maned buffaloes of the West have fled before a solitary horseman. Witness, too, all human beings, how when herded together in the sheepfold of a theater's pit, they will, at the slightest alarm of fire, rush helter-skelter for the outlets, crowding, trampling, jamming, and remorselessly dashing each other to death. Best, therefore, withhold any amazement at the strangely gallied whales before us, for there is no folly of the beasts of the earth which is not infinitely outdone by the madness of men. Though many of the whales were still in violent motion, yet as a whole the herd neither advanced nor retreated, but collectively remained in one place. As is customary in those cases, the boats at once separated, each making for some one lone whale on the outskirts of the shoal. In about 3 minutes' time, Queequeg's harpoon was flung. The stricken fish darted blinding spray in our faces, and then running away with us like light, steered straight for the heart of the herd. though such a movement on the part of the whale struck under such circumstances is in no wise unprecedented, and indeed is almost always more or less anticipated, yet does it present one of the more perilous vicissitudes of the fishery. For as the swift monster drags you deeper and deeper into the frantic shoal, you bid adieu to circumspect life and only exist in a delirious throb. As blind and deaf, the whale plunged forward, as if by sheer power of speed to rid himself of the iron leech that had fastened to him. As we thus tore a white gash in the sea, on all sides menaced as we flew by the crazed creatures to and fro rushing about us, our beset boat was like a ship mobbed by ice isles in a tempest, and striving to steer through their complicated channels and straits, knowing not at what moment it may be locked in and crushed. But not a bit daunted, Queequeg steered us manfully, now sheering off from this monster directly across our route in advance, now edging away from that whose colossal flukes were suspended overhead. All the time Starbuck stood up in the bows, lance in hand, pricking out of our way whatever whales he could reach by short darts, for there was no time to make long ones. Nor were the oarsmen quite idle, though their wonted duty was now altogether dispensed with. They chiefly attended to the shouting part of the business.
"Out of the way, Commodore!"
cried one to a great dromedary that of a sudden rose bodily to the surface and for an instant threatened to swamp us.
"Hard down with your tail there!"
cried a second to another which, close to our gunwale, seemed calmly cooling himself with his own fan-like extremity. All whaleboats carry certain curious contrivances, originally invented by the Nantucket Indians, called drugs. Two thick squares of wood of equal size are stoutly clenched together, so that they cross each other's grain at right angles. A line of considerable length is then attached to the middle of this block, and the other end of the line being looped, it can in a moment be fastened to a harpoon. It is chiefly among gallied whales that this drug is used, for then more whales are close round you than you can possibly chase at one time. But sperm whales are not every day encountered. While you may, then, you must kill all you can. And if you cannot kill them all at once, you must wing them, so that they can be afterwards killed at your leisure. Hence it is that at times like these, the drug comes into requisition. Our boat was furnished with three of them. The first and second were successfully darted, and we saw the whales staggeringly running off, fettered by the enormous sidelong resistance of the towing drug. They were cramped like malefactors with the chain and ball. But upon flinging the third, in the act of tossing overboard the clumsy wooden block, it caught under one of the seats of the boat, and in an instant tore it out and carried it away, dropping the oarsman in the boat's bottom as the seat slid from under him. On both sides, the sea came in at the wounded planks, but we stuffed two or three drawers and shirts in, and so stopped the leaks for the time. It would have been next to impossible to dart these drugged harpoons, were it not that, as we advanced into the herd, our whale's way greatly diminished. Moreover, as we went still further and further from the circumference of commotion, the direful disorders seemed waning. So that when at last the jerking harpoon drew out, and the towing whale sideways vanished, then, with the tapering force of his parting momentum, we glided between two whales into the innermost heart of the shoal, as if from some mountain torrent we had slid into a serene valley lake. Here the storms in the roaring glens between the outermost whales were heard but not felt. In this central expanse the sea presented that smooth, satin-like surface called a sleek, produced by the subtle moisture thrown off by the whale in his more quiet moods. Yes, we were now in that enchanted calm which they say lurks at the heart of every commotion. And still, in the distracted distance, we beheld the tumults of the outer concentric circles, and saw successive pods of whales, 8 or 10 in each, swiftly going round and round, like multiplied spans of horses in a ring, and so closely shoulder to shoulder that a circus rider might easily have overarched the middle ones and so have gone round on their backs. Owing to the density of the crowd of reposing whales, more immediately surrounding the axis of the herd, no possible chance of escape was at present afforded us. We must watch for a breach in the living wall that hemmed us in, the wall that had only admitted us in order to shut us up. At last we shot into a temporary opening, then giving way rapidly, and at the same time earnestly watching for another outlet. After many hair-breadth escapes, we finally glided into what had just been one of the outer circles, but was now crossed by random whales, all violently making for one center. This lucky salvation was cheaply purchased by the loss of Queequeg's hat, who, while standing in the bows to prick the fugitive whales, had his hat taken clean from his head by the air eddy made by the sudden tossing of a pair of broad flukes close by. Riotous and disordered as the universal commotion now was, it soon resolved itself into what seemed a systematic movement, for having clumped together at last in one dense body, the whales then renewed their onward flight with augmented fleetness. Further pursuit was useless, but the boats still lingered in their wake to pick up what drugged whales might be dropped astern, and likewise to secure one which Flask had killed. The result of this lowering was somewhat illustrative of that sagacious saying in the fishery, "The more whales, the less fish." Of all the drugged whales, only one was captured, and the rest contrived to escape. Though such great bodies of sperm whales are at times encountered, yet small detached bands are more usually observed, embracing from 20 to 50 individuals each. Such bands are known as schools. They generally are of two sorts, those composed almost entirely of females, and those mustering none but young, vigorous males, or bulls, as they are familiarly designated. In cavalier attendance upon the school of females, you invariably see a male of full-grown magnitude, but not old, who, upon any alarm, evinces his gallantry by falling in the rear and covering the flight of his ladies. While he is always of the largest leviathanic proportions, the ladies, even at full growth, are not more than one-third of the bulk of an average-sized male. They are comparatively delicate. Indeed, I dare say, not to exceed half a dozen yards round the waist. It is very curious to watch this harem and its lord in their indolent ramblings. Like fashionables, they are forever on the move in leisurely search of variety. You meet them on the line in time for the full flower of the equatorial feeding season, having just returned, perhaps, from spending the summer in the northern seas, and so cheating summer of all unpleasant weariness and warmth. By the time they have lounged up and down the promenade of the equator a while, they start for the oriental waters, in anticipation of the cool season there, and so evade the other excessive temperature of the year. When serenely advancing on one of these journeys, if any strange, suspicious sights are seen, my Lord Whale keeps a wary eye on his interesting family. Should any unwarrantably pert young leviathan coming that way presume to draw confidentially close to one of the ladies, with what prodigious fury the Lord assails him and chases him away. As ashore, the ladies often cause the most terrible duels among their rival admirers, just so with whales, who sometimes come to deadly battle, and all for love. They fence with their long lower jaws, sometimes locking them together, and so striving for the supremacy like elks that warringly interweave their antlers. Not a few are captured having the deep scars of these encounters, furrowed heads, broken teeth, scalloped fins, and in some instances, wrenched and dislocated mouths. Now, as the harem of whales is called by the fishermen a school, so is the lord and master of that school technically known as the schoolmaster. The same secludedness and isolation to which the schoolmaster whale betakes himself in his advancing years is true of all aged sperm whales. Almost universally, a lone whale proves an ancient one. Like venerable moss-bearded Daniel Boone, he will have no one near him but nature herself. The schools composing none but young and vigorous males offer a strong contrast to the harem schools, for while those female whales are characteristically timid, the young males or 40-barrel bulls, as they call them, are by far the most pugnacious of all leviathans, and proverbially the most dangerous to encounter, excepting those wondrous, gray-headed, grizzled whales sometimes met, and these will fight you like grim fiends exasperated by a penal gout. The 40-barrel bull schools are larger than the harem schools. Like a mob of young collegians, they are full of fight, fun, and wickedness, tumbling round the world at such a reckless, rollicking rate that no prudent underwriter would insure them any more than he would a riotous lad at Yale or Harvard. They soon relinquish this turbulence, though, and when about 3/4 grown, break up and separately go about in quest of settlements, that is, harems. Another point of difference between the male and female schools is still more characteristic of the sexes. Say you strike a 40-barrel bull. Poor devil, all his comrades quit him. But strike a member of the harem school, and her companions swim around her with every token of concern, sometimes lingering so near her and so long as themselves to fall a prey. It was but some few days after the last lowering that the most significant event befell the most insignificant of the Pequod's crew. This event was most lamentable, and it ended in providing the sometimes madly merry and predestinated craft with a living and ever-accompanying prophecy of whatever shattered sequel might prove her own. Now, in the whale ship, it is not everyone that goes in the boats. Some few hands are reserved, called shipkeepers, whose province it is to work the vessel while the boats are pursuing the whale. As a general thing, these shipkeepers are as hardy fellows as the men comprising the boat's crews. But if there happened to be an unduly slender, clumsy, or timorous wight in the ship, that wight is certain to be made a shipkeeper. It was so in the Pequod, with the little negro Pippin by nickname, Pip by abbreviation. Poor Pip. He was very bright, with that pleasant, genial, jolly brightness peculiar to his tribe, a tribe which ever enjoy all holidays and festivities with finer, freer relish than any other race. For blacks, the year's calendar should show naught but 365 Fourth of Julys and New Year's Days. Pip loved life and all life's peaceable securities, so that the panic-striking business in which he had somehow unaccountably become entrapped had most sadly blurred his brightness. It came to pass that Stubbs, after oarsman, chanced so to sprain his hand as for some time to become quite maimed, and temporarily Pip was put in his place. The first time Stubb lowered with him, Pip evinced much nervousness, but happily, for that time, escaped close contact with the whale, and therefore came off not altogether discreditably, though Stubb, observing him, took care afterwards to exhort him to cherish his courageousness to the utmost, for he might often find it needful. Now, upon the second lowering, the boat paddled upon the whale, and as the fish received the darted iron, it gave its customary rap, which happened in this instance to be right under poor Pip's seat. The involuntary consternation of the moment caused him to leap, paddle in hand, out of the boat, and in such a way that part of the slack whale line coming against his chest, he breasted it overboard with him, so as to become entangled in it, when at last plumping into the water. That instant the stricken whale started on a fierce run. The line swiftly straightened, and poor Pip came all foaming up to the chocks of the boat, remorselessly dragged there by the line which had taken several turns around his chest and neck. Tashtego stood in the bows. He was full of the fire of the hunt. He hated Pip for a poltroon. Snatching the boat knife from its sheath, he suspended its sharp edge over the line, and turning toward Stubb, exclaimed interrogatively,
"Cut?"
Meantime, Pip's blue, choked face plainly looked, "Do, for God's sake!" In less than half a minute, this entire thing happened.
"Damn him, cut!" roared Stubb,
and so the whale was lost, and Pip was saved. As soon as he recovered himself, the poor little negro was assailed by yells and execrations from the crew. Tranquilly permitting these irregular cursings to evaporate, Stubb then, in a plain, businesslike, but still half-humorous manner, cursed Pip officially, and that done, unofficially gave him much wholesome advice. The substance was, never jump from a boat, Pip, except... But all the rest was indefinite, as the soundest advice ever is. Now, in general, stick to the boat is your true motto in whaling, but cases will sometimes happen when leap from the boat is still better. Moreover, as if perceiving at last that if he should give undiluted, conscientious advice to Pip, he would be leaving him too wide a margin to jump in for the future, Stubb suddenly dropped all advice and concluded with a peremptory command. Stick to the boat, Pip, or by the Lord, I won't pick you up if you jump. Mind that. We can't afford to lose whales by the likes of you. A whale would sell for 30 times what you would, Pip, in Alabama. Bear that in mind, and don't jump any more. Hereby, perhaps, Stubb indirectly hinted that though man loves his fellow, yet man is a money-making animal, which propensity too often interferes with his benevolence. But we are all in the hands of the gods, and Pip jumped again. It was under very similar circumstances to the first performance, but this time he did not breast out the line, and hence when the whales started to run, Pip was left behind on the sea, like a hurried traveler's trunk. Alas, Stubb was but too true to his word. It was a beautiful, bounteous blue day, the spangled sea calm and cool, and flatly stretching away all round to the horizon, like gold-beater's skin hammered out to the extremest. Bobbing up and down in that sea, Pip's ebon head showed like a head of cloves. No boat knife was lifted when he fell so rapidly astern. Stubb's inexorable back was turned upon him, and the whale was winged. In 3 minutes, a whole mile of shoreless ocean was between Pip and Stubb. Out from the center of the sea, poor Pip turned his crisp, curling black head to the sun, another lonely castaway, though the loftiest and the brightest. But had Stubb really abandoned the poor little Negro to his fate? No. He did not mean to, at least because there were 2 boats in his wake, and he supposed, no doubt, that they would, of course, come up to Pip very quickly and pick him up. Though indeed such considerateness towards oarsmen jeopardized through their own timidity is not always manifested by the hunters in all similar instances, and such instances not unfrequently occur, almost invariably in the fishery, a coward, so-called, is marked with the same ruthless detestation peculiar to military navies and armies. But it so happened that those boats, without seeing Pip, and suddenly spying whales close to them on one side, turned and gave chase. And Stubb's boat was now so far away, and he and all his crew so intent upon his fish, that Pip's ringed horizon began to expand around him miserably. By the merest chance, the ship itself at last rescued him. But from that hour, the little Negro went about the deck an idiot. Such, at least, they said he was. The sea had jeeringly kept his finite body up, but drowned the infinite of his soul. Not drowned entirely, though. Rather carried down alive to wondrous depths, where strange shapes of the unwarped primal world glided to and fro before his passive eyes. Side 5. It was some 2 or 3 weeks after this tragic incident that a ship showing English colors bore down under the stern.
"Ship ahoy!" cried Ahab at once. "Hast seen the white whale?"
Trumpet to mouth, the old man was standing in his hoisted quarter boat, his ivory leg plainly revealed to the stranger captain, who was carelessly reclining in his own boat's prow. He was a dark-tanned, burly, good-natured, fine-looking man of 60 or thereabouts, dressed in a spacious roundabout that hung round him in festoons of blue pilot cloth, and one empty arm of this jacket streamed behind him like the broidered arm of a hussar's surcoat.
"Hast seen the white whale?" Ahab repeated.
"See ye this?" the stranger captain replied, and withdrawing it from the folds that had hidden it, he held up a white arm of sperm whalebone, terminating in a wooden head like a mallet.
"Man my boat!"
cried Ahab impetuously, and tossing about the oars near him.
Stand by to lower!
In less than a minute, without quitting his little craft, he and his crew were dropped to the water and were soon alongside of the stranger. But here a curious difficulty presented itself. In the excitement of the moment, Ahab had forgotten that since the loss of his leg, he had never once stepped on board of any vessel at sea but his own, and then it was always by an ingenious and very handy mechanical contrivance peculiar to the Pequod, and a thing not to be rigged or shipped in any other vessel at a moment's warning. But this awkwardness only lasted a minute, because the strange captain, observing at a glance how affairs stood, cried out,
I see, avast heaving there! Jump, boys, and swing over the cutting tackle!
Soon he was carefully swung inside the high bulwarks, and gently landed upon the capstan head. With his ivory arm frankly thrust forth in welcome, the other captain advanced, and Ahab, putting out his ivory leg, and crossing the ivory arm like two swordfish blades, cried out in his walrus way,
Aye, aye, hearty, let us shake bones together, an arm and a leg, an arm that can never shrink, and a leg that can never run. Where didst thou see the white whale? How long ago?
The white whale, said the Englishman, pointing his ivory arm towards the east, and taking a rueful sight along it, as if it had been a telescope.
I saw him there, on the line, last season. And he took that arm off, did he? Asked Ahab, now sliding down from the capstan and resting on the Englishman's shoulder as he did so.
Yes, he was the cause of it, at least. And that leg, too?
Aye, said Ahab. How was it? Spin me the yarn.
It was the first time in my life that I ever cruised on the line, began the Englishman. I was ignorant of the white whale at that time. Well, one day we lowered for a pod of 4 or 5 whales, and my boat fastened to one of them. A regular circus horse he was, too, that went milling and milling round so that my boat's crew could only trim dish by sitting all their sterns on the outer gunwale. Presently up breaches from the bottom of the sea a bouncing great whale with a milky white head and hump, all crow's feet and wrinkles. It was he! It was he! Cried Ahab, suddenly letting out his suspended breath. And harpoon sticking in near his starboard fin. Aye, aye, they were mine, my irons!
Cried Ahab exultingly. Go on.
Give me a chance, then, said the Englishman good-humoredly. Well, this old great-grandfather with the white head and hump runs all afoam into the pod and goes to snapping furiously at my fast line.
Aye, I see, wanted to part it, free the fast fish, an old trick. I know him.
How it was exactly, continued the one-armed commander. I do not know, but in biting the line it got foul of his teeth, caught there somehow. But we didn't know it then, so that when we afterwards pulled on the line, bounce we came plumb onto his hump, instead of the other whales that went off to windward all fluking. Seeing how matters stood, and what a noble great whale it was, the noblest and biggest I ever saw, sir, in my life, I resolved to capture him, spite of the boiling rage he seemed to be in, and thinking the haphazard line would get loose, or the tooth it was tangled to might draw, for I have a devil of a boat's crew for a pull on a whale line. Seeing all this, I say, I jumped into my first mate's boat, Mr. Mounttop's here, which was gunwale and gunwale with mine, and snatching the first harpoon, let this old great-grandfather have it. But Lord, look you, sir, hearts and souls alive, man, the next instant in a jiff, I was blind as a bat, all befogged and bedeadened with black foam, the whale's tail looming straight up out of it, perpendicular in the air like a marble steeple. No use sterning at all then. But as I was groping at midday with a blinding sun, after the second iron to toss it overboard, down comes the tail like a Lima tower, cutting my boat in two, leaving each half in splinters, and flukes first, the great white hump backed through the wreck as though it was all chips. We all struck out. To escape his terrible flailings, I seized hold of my harpoon pole sticking in him, and for a moment clung to that like a sucking fish. but a combing sea dashed me off, and at the same instant the fish, taking one good dart forwards, went down like a flash, and the barb of that cursed second iron towing along near me caught me here, clapping his hand just below his shoulder. Yes, caught me just here, I say, and bore me down to hell's flames, I was thinking, when all of a sudden, thank the good God, the barb ripped its way along the flesh, clear along the whole length of my arm, came out nigh my wrist, and up I floated. What became of the white whale? Now cried Ahab. Well, after he sounded, we didn't see him again for some time. In fact, as I before hinted, I didn't then know what whale it was that had served me such a trick, till some time afterwards, when coming back to the line, we heard about Moby Dick, and then I knew it was he. Didst thou cross his wake again? Twice, but could not fasten. Didn't want to try to. Ain't one limb enough? What should I do without this other arm? And I'm thinking Moby Dick doesn't bite so much as he swallows. Oh, thank ye. He's welcome to the arm he has, since I can't help it, and didn't know him then, but not to another one. No more white whales for me. I've lowered for him once, and that has satisfied me. There would be great glory in killing him, I know that, and there is a shipload of precious sperm in him. But hark ye, he's best let alone. Don't you think so, Captain? Glancing at the ivory leg. He is, but he will still be hunted for all that. What is best, let alone that accursed thing, is not always what least allures. He's all a magnet. How long since thou sawest him last? Which way heading?
Good God, cried the English captain, to whom the question was put. What's the matter? He was heading east, I think.
Is your captain crazy? Whispering to Fedallah. But Fedallah, putting a finger on his lip, slid over the bulwarks to take the boat's steering oar, and Ahab, swinging the cutting tackle towards him, commanded the ship's sailors to stand by to lower. In a moment he was standing in the boat's stern, and the Manila men were springing to their oars. In vain the English captain hailed him. With back to the stranger ship, and face set like a flint to his own, Ahab stood upright to the long side of the Pequod. According to usage, they were pumping the ship next morning, and lo, no inconsiderable oil came up with the water. The casks below must have sprung a bad leak. Much concern was shown, and Starbuck went down into the cabin to report this unfavorable affair. Now, from the south and west, the Pequod was drawing nigh to Formosa and the Bashi Isles, between which lies one of the tropical outlets from the China waters into the Pacific. And so Starbuck found Ahab with a general chart of the Oriental archipelago spread before him, and another separate one representing the long eastern coasts of the Japanese islands, Nippon, Matsumae, and Sikoke.
Who's there?
Hearing the footstep at the door, but not turning round to it.
On deck, be gone!
Captain Ahab mistakes. It is I. The oil in the hold is leaking, sir. We must up Burton's and break out.
Up Burton's and break out. Now that we are nearing Japan, heave to here for a week to tinker a parcel of old hoops.
Either we do that, sir, or waste in one day more oil than we may make good in a year. What we came 20,000 miles to get is worth saving, sir.
So it is. So it is, if we get it.
I was speaking of the oil in the hold, sir.
And I was not speaking or thinking of that at all. Begone. Let it leak. I'm all a leak myself. Aye, leaks in leaks. Not only full of leaky casks, but those leaky casks are in a leaky ship. And that's a far worse plight than the Pequod's men. Yet I don't stop to plug my leak. For who can find it in the deep-loaded hull? Or how hope to plug it, even if found, in this life's howling gale? Starbuck, I'll not have the burdens hoisted.
What will the owners say, sir?
Let the owners stand on Nantucket Beach and out-yell the typhoon. What cares Ahab? Owners, owners, thou art always prating to me, Starbuck, about those miserly owners, as if the owners were my conscience. But look ye, the only real owner of anything is its commander. And hark ye, my conscience is in this ship's keel. On deck!
"Captain Ahab," said the reddening mate, moving further into the cabin, with a daring so strangely respectful and cautious that it almost seemed not only every way seeking to avoid the slightest outward manifestation of itself, but within also seemed more than half distrustful of itself. "A better man than I might well pass over in thee what he would quickly enough resent in a younger man, aye, and in a happier, Captain Ahab."
"Devils, dost thou then so much as dare to critically think of me on deck?"
"Nay, sir, not yet, I do entreat. And I do dare, sir, to be forbearing. Shall we not understand each other better than hitherto, Captain Ahab?"
Ahab seized a loaded musket from the rack, and pointing it toward Starbuck, exclaimed,
"There is one God that is Lord over the earth, and one Captain that is Lord over the Pequod, on deck!"
For an instant in the flashing eyes of the mate and his fiery cheeks, you would have almost thought that he had really received the blaze of the leveled tube. But mastering his emotion, he half-calmly rose, and as he quitted the cabin, paused for an instant and said, "Thou hast outraged, not insulted me, sir. But for that I ask thee not to beware of Starbuck. Thou wouldst but laugh. But let Ahab beware of Ahab. Beware of thyself, old man."
"He waxes brave, but nevertheless obeys most careful bravery that," murmured Ahab, as Starbuck disappeared. "What's that?" he said. "Ahab, beware of Ahab. There's something there."
Then unconsciously using the musket for a staff, with an iron brow he paced to and fro in the little cabin.
Now, at this time it was that my poor pagan companion and fast bosom friend Queequeg caught a terrible chill which lapsed into a fever, and at last, after some days' suffering, laid him in his hammock close to the very sill of the door of death. How he wasted and wasted away in those few long lingering days, till there seemed but little left of him but his frame and tattooing. But as all else in him thinned, and his cheekbones grew sharper, his eyes, nevertheless, seemed growing fuller and fuller. They became of a strange softness of luster, and mildly but deeply looked out at you there from his sickness, a wondrous testimony to that immortal health in him which could not die or be weakened. And like circles on the water, which, as they grow fainter, expand, his eyes seemed rounding and rounding, like the rings of eternity. Not a man of his crew but gave him up, and as for Queequeg himself, what he thought of his case was forcibly shown by a curious favor he asked. He called one to him in the gray morning watch, when the day was just breaking, and taking his hand, said that while in Nantucket he had chanced to see certain little canoes of dark wood, like the rich warwood of his native isle, and upon inquiry he had learned that all whalemen who died in Nantucket were laid in those same dark canoes, and that the fancy of being so laid had much pleased him. It was not unlike the custom of his own race, who, after embalming a dead warrior, stretched him out in his canoe, and so left him to be floated away to the starry archipelagos. For not only do they believe that the stars are isles, but that far beyond all visible horizons, their own mild, uncontinented seas interflow with the blue heavens, and form the white breakers of the Milky Way. He added that he shuddered at the thought of being buried in his hammock, according to the usual sea custom, and tossed like something vile to the death-devouring sharks. No, he desired a canoe like those of Nantucket. Now, when this strange circumstance was made known aft, the carpenter was at once commanded to do Queequeg's bidding, whatever it might include. There was some heathenish, coffin-colored old lumber aboard, which upon a long previous voyage had been cut from an aboriginal grove of the Lackaday Islands, and from these dark planks the coffin was recommended to be made. No sooner was the carpenter apprised of the order than, taking his rule, he forthwith, with all the indifferent promptitude of his character, proceeded into the forecastle and took Queequeg's measure with great accuracy, regularly chalking Queequeg's person as he shifted the rule.
"Yeah, poor fellow! He'll have to die now,
ejaculated the Long Island sailor. Going to his vice bench, the carpenter, for convenience' sake and general reference, now transferringly measured onto it the exact length the coffin was to be, and then made the transfer permanent by cutting two notches at its extremities. This done, he marshaled the planks and his tools and set to work. When the last nail was driven and the lid duly planed and fitted, he lightly shouldered the coffin and went forward with it, inquiring whether they were ready for it yet in that direction. Overhearing the indignant but half-humorous cries with which the people on deck began to drive the coffin away, Queequeg, to everyone's consternation, commanded that the thing should be instantly brought to him. Nor was there any denying him, seeing that, of all mortals, some dying men are the most tyrannical, and certainly, since they will shortly trouble us so little for evermore, the poor fellow ought to be indulged. Leaning over in his hammock, Queequeg long regarded the coffin with an attentive eye. He then called for his harpoon, had the wooden stock drawn from it, and then had the iron part placed in the coffin along with one of the paddles of his boat. All by his own request, also, biscuits were then ranged round the sides within, a flask of fresh water was placed at the head, and a small bag of woody earth scraped up in the hold at the foot, and a piece of sailcloth being rolled up for a pillow. Queequeg now entreated to be lifted into his final bed, that he might make trial of its comforts, if any it had. He lay without moving for a few minutes. Then, "Rarmai, it will do, it is easy," he murmured at last, and signed to be replaced in his hammock. But now that he had apparently made every preparation for death, now that his coffin was proved a good fit, Queequeg suddenly rallied. Soon there seemed no need of the carpenter's box, and thereupon, when some expressed their delighted surprise, he in substance said that the cause of his sudden convalescence was this. At a critical moment, he had just recalled a little duty ashore, which he was leaving undone, and therefore had changed his mind about dying. He could not die yet, he averred. They asked him then whether to live or die was a matter of his own sovereign will and pleasure. He answered certainly. In a word, it was Queequeg's conceit that if a man made up his mind to live, mere sickness could not kill him. Nothing but a whale or a gale or some violent, ungovernable, unintelligent destroyer of that sort. Now, there is this noteworthy difference between savage and civilized, that while a sick, civilized man may be 6 months convalescing, generally speaking, a sick savage is almost half well again in a day. So in good time, Queequeg gained strength, and at length, after sitting on the windlass for a few indolent days, but eating with a vigorous appetite, he suddenly leaped to his feet, threw out arms and legs, gave himself a good stretching, yawned a little bit, and then springing into the head of his hoisted boat and poising a harpoon, pronounced himself fit for a fight. With a wild whimsiness, he now used his coffin for a sea chest, and emptying into it his canvas bag of clothes, set them in order. Many spare hours he spent in carving the lid with all manner of grotesque figures, and it seemed that hereby he was striving, in his rude way, to copy parts of the twisted tattooing on his body. And this tattooing had been the work of a departed prophet and seer of his island, who by these hieroglyphic marks had written out on his body a complete theory of the heavens and the earth, and a mystical treatise on the art of attaining truth, so that Queequeg, in his own proper person, was a riddle to unfold, a wondrous work in one volume, but whose mysteries not even himself could read, though his own live heart beat against them. And those mysteries were therefore destined, in the end, to molder away with the living parchment whereon they were inscribed, and so be unsolved to the last. When gliding by the Bashi Isles, we emerged at last upon the great South Sea. Were it not for other things, I would have greeted my dear Pacific with uncounted thanks, for now the long supplication of my youth was answered, That serene ocean rolled eastwards from me 1,000 leagues of blue. There is, one knows not what sweet mystery about this sea, whose gently awful stirrings seem to speak of some hidden soul beneath. It rolls the midmost waters of the world, the Indian Ocean and Atlantic being but its arms. The same waves wash the moles of the new-built Californian town, but yesterday planted by the recentest race of men, and lave the faded but still gorgeous skirts of Asiatic lands older than Abraham, while all between float milky ways of coral isles and low-lying endless unknown archipelagos and impenetrable Japans. Thus this mysterious, divine Pacific zones the world's whole bulk about, makes all coasts one bay to it, seems the tide-beating heart of earth. Lifted by those eternal swells, you needs must own the seductive god, bowing your head to Pan. But few thoughts of Pan stirred Ahab's brain, as standing like an iron statue at his accustomed place beside the mizzen rigging, with one nostril he unthinkingly snuffed the sugary musk from the Bashi Isles, and with the other consciously inhaled the salt breath of the new-found sea. That sea in which the hated white whale must even then be swimming. Launched at length upon these almost final waters, and gliding towards the Japanese cruising ground, the old man's purpose intensified itself. His firm lips met like the lips of a vice. His forehead's veins swelled like overladen brooks. In his very sleep, his ringing cry ran through the vaulted hull.
Stern all! The white whale spouts thick blood!